And the Leafs, despite losing two defensemen in the second period and their starting goaltender in the first, are going to skate off with a 6-4 victory over the Boston Bruins.
If they want to go around and do that, they're more than welcome to. It doesn't bother us at all as a group. Thought that we stuck together well. We matched them, and we controlled the pace of the game for the most part. So it was a good win for us. We're going to play them more down the stretch here, and we'll be prepared again.
Hey, everybody, it's the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, J.D. Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, and Blake Murphy. And I agree with that assessment. Leafs win, Leafs win, Leafs win. Of course, they can't beat the Habs because, God, you just can't possibly beat the Montreal Canadiens. Just last night, getting drubbed 7-4 against the Leafs. Can't do it. Can't score against that team. But then wins against the Panthers and the Boston Bruins. And last night, we went into that game. And we said, this is a measuring stick. Tonight is a measuring stick game. And I think the Boston Bruins will kind of always be that for the Maple Leafs. Especially even this core. And no matter what iteration of player wears those uniforms, when Patrice Bergeron maybe is gone, when Brad Marchand is too tiny to even matter and too old to make a peep.
Do you think he's going to shrink?
Yeah, I do. That's my insinuation there. Is that he's going to get a little He's going to get a little tiny. Leafs measuring stick game. Ailish Forfar. Are you taking anything from it? Did you see anything in that game, in the measuring stick game, that you think matters?
Yeah, hell yeah. The Leafs lost a lot of players and continued to fight. I mean, it got a little close in the end, but they played a very chippy Boston Bruins team. It could have got very out of hand. The forwards were pretty dominant, I would say. The D held it together with only 4D by the end of the game. Our buddy Schalgren stepped in and had to play in a bit of an awkward situation. I think there's a lot of positives to pull from it. Obviously, there's a lot of question marks, and we're going to talk to Luke Fox about that later on, about, okay, what can we expect? And Justin Bourne, about what's going on with the players that are injured. But if you take that away from it, I think that Toronto outplayed Boston, and they held it together in a playoff-type atmosphere, just like they had done on Sunday against the Florida Panthers. So I look at stringing those two type of games together as a big win for Toronto Maple Leafs.
So the injuries thing was weird, right? Because Paul gets hit in the head. And then there's just kind of blood everywhere, and he goes off, and you go, oh, well, this is serious. He gets put in protocol, and Sheldon Keefe says that these two guys have to be reassessed, and then obviously Ilya Lyubushkin gets the sucker punch and he doesn't return. He gets holed out for precautionary reasons. You hope that both guys are okay. I don't know. You can't really play doctor with head injuries, but my guess is that neither guy is going to be out for the season, right? That didn't feel like in the moment that either guy was in real distress. For what that's worth, the Mrazek injury,
oof,
he's starting to turn it around, clearly, because you can't play worse than the guy who was playing. But when he left the game, you kind of went same diff, like with Schalgren in net. Until the end of that game, I was thinking, wow, Schalgren's really poised. And I kind of trust this kid. I sneaky trust this kid. And then the moment got really big, and puck started going in the net. And a 6-2 game quickly started to creep up. Here's the 6-3. The Taylor Hall goal happens, and one of the worst calls I've seen in the history of hockey, which was amazing. That ref, that was one of the most, it wasn't one of the worst calls, I should say. It was just one of the most hero ref calls where it was like, nope, like you did a bad, and I saw it. And then everyone in live time went, pardon me. Either way, Schalgren, that scared me a little bit. That was a reminder of, oh my God, Jack Campbell needs to be good or they're dead, because
he's apparently
like
coming
that
back soon, so that's positive.
But even if he comes back, the version of him I mentioned to you, Ailish, before the show, that Marc-Andre Fleury got first star last night with Minnesota. They beat the Flyers. It's not like it was anybody insane, but I'm watching Marc-Andre Fleury make saves. He's diving around, flashing the beautiful brown leather like he's Dominic Hasek. It was just a bit of a reminder of, hey, you know what probably would have been good as Marc-Andre Fleury, as much as we went like sub 900 save. Here's what I'll tell you. If Marc-Andre Fleury was in net for the Leafs right now, it probably wouldn't feel like they had, you know, Eric Schalgren back there when the game was being blown apart. Either way, Blake Murphy, measuring stick game. Biggest takeaway from the night.
Oh, my biggest takeaway is that we're very, very close to seeing my guy Joey Duzak finally. All these injuries blue line, we're finally going to get him.
Did you hear what Sheldon Keefe said postgame?
No, I didn't.
He was going to put forwards back there.
Yeah, they were considering it. He said that it would be centers. That was the idea. Kind of, it does, but also I don't want to see the good ones do that. So
David Camp would be the guy.
Yeah, I thought, do you get a Camp Kerfoot pairing? That's where I go. The Camp.
Oh, you wouldn't put two out there together, I don't think.
No.
Buddy Blackwell back there. He can play anywhere.
They need his offense, Ailish.
Blackwell
for Hart.
I got to tell you, Blackwell, after that goal, there were some tough spots.
He got it on the scoreboard. Well, everyone was tweeting at me, catching the Blackwell fan franchise here. Thank you.
Blackwell, that was a really nice goal, and it was a really nice shift. And the fourth line actually did pop for the first time in forever. And I felt bad for Wayne Simmonds because it was one of those, I don't know when you're ever coming back onto the roster games, especially considering the next part, which is I didn't miss him with the physical stuff. I didn't miss him with the rough stuff. So you can set yourself up for failure with something like this, because this is how Leaf fans are, right? They remember anybody that shows any sign of positivity and just hammers them with it if things go wrong. And that's fair, right? That's fair. You can believe that this organization is cursed and that they can never win and that it's an impossibility and that there is something that hangs over them that will just never work and never operate. I think a lot of people saw Ilya Lyubushkin get sucker punched and the Leafs not immediately turn it into a melee and took it as a sign as of, hey, this Leafs team is soft. Hey, this Leafs team doesn't stick up for one another, and push come to shove, a team like the Boston Bruins in a 7-game series are going to be able to wear those guys down. But what I actually saw was incredibly hopeful, more hopeful than the Panthers game, certainly more hopeful than the Panthers game. We've done this thing of, like, we had Dangle on yesterday. We talked about ghosts, and we did this whole thing on, well, you don't want to face Boston because the demons and the ghosts and all this different stuff. And it's one of those things, like, you ever meet someone and they're younger than you, not you, Ailish. This is only for Blake. This is only really for Blake. But, or you've experienced something where someone meets you younger and someone meets you like as an intern. My experience of this would be when I was an intern in the industry, I think some people never saw me more as an intern that were older than me. And I think we feel that way about the Leafs sometimes, where we look at them against the Boston Bruins and they're the intern. They're the young upstart. They're the guys that, hey, someday you're going to be something, kid, but not today. This is still our time, us being the Boston Bruins. And yesterday, as Boston was flailing away and throwing sucker punches and throwing cross checks and really trying to get under the skin of the Maple Leafs, I didn't see anybody whose games changed. I didn't see Austin Matthews wilt away. I didn't see William Nylander wilt away. I didn't see John Tavares move off of his demeanor. Mitch Marner continued to play terrific. And the Leafs just stood in there. And they just looked like a normal hockey team. And maybe over the course of 7 games, that changes. Maybe over the course of 7 games, that physicality will wear on you. There will be a moment where you show a little bit of weakness or you stumble, but I just saw a group of guys that were kind of grown up, and I really did. I saw them in a different light, and if we're doing measuring stick games, this measuring stick game actually mattered to me more than just about any other one that we've ever thrown out there in terms of, well, the Leafs and comparing them and getting your hopes up. I'm not saying that they're definitely going to win, but I'm saying that I don't look at them as soft just because they don't go out there and beat the living bleep out of everybody else, because they're never going to be built that way. I feel like people keep expecting one day Austin Matthews, just because he's big, is going to fill somebody's face in, and it's not going to happen. Mitch Marner's never going to grow 6 inches. William Nylander's not all of a sudden going to wear foil. Like, it's not going to happen. They are who they are in the sense of what they're going to do in that regard. But when it comes to being intimidated and bullied and pushed around, I saw a team that looked like they're growing up. I saw a team that was unafraid.
Yeah, I thought the composure was great. I thought, you know, one way to there's a couple different ways to take a physical game like that as the other team gets chippy, right? And one of those ways is to sink down to that level and throw Kyle Clifford out there for a couple extra shifts and muck it up. The other way is score immediately on the power play and take complete control of the game, to where, like, at one point it's 6-1 and that crowd is dead. Like, if there was any, hey, Boston's physical style is going to bring the crowd out of this and they're going to turn 3-1 or 4-1 into something. At JD, you and I were even texting around the time it was 3-1, and it felt like Boston was building some of that and the arena was building some of that. And then it's like, oh, yeah. You don't really want to give Mitch Marner and Austin Matthews advantages like that. So I do think that's one way to handle it. And I actually thought that a lot of this game for Boston wasn't really they're playing a physical playoff style of hockey. I thought they were undisciplined. I thought this is a team that's top five in the league in times shorthanded per game. This is not a team that has found that proper balance yet in terms of, hey, we're going to be physical and we're going to try to be intimidating, but we're also going to stop undercutting ourselves and putting ourselves shorthanded. That's what I saw from that one. And you're right. Like, a 7-game series, maybe that plays out differently. The whistle's a little tighter. The physicality wears on you over 7 games. And, you know, if you're William Nylander, who I thought last night did a great job getting to the dirty areas relative to the couple games before, you know, maybe you stop going to those areas because it's taking a physical toll. But for a single game, I thought that looked like a Boston team that was frustrated and lost the handle on being disciplined a little bit.
I think the Bruins underestimated the Leafs, and that's why they had the type of behind the eight ball type play. Their goaltender, you know, we talked about, he came in with like 11-1-1 over the last 13 games. Like, I was like, who is this guy? And he got
my biggest point of confidence was him. My biggest point of confidence in a series against them is that you get to face Jeremy Swayman. I went, that's your guy. And
but
I know everybody can
stats,
have one bad game, but boy, the style was very not playoff friendly, I would say.
So, you could say I think it was Mrazek-y.
It was Mrazek-y.
But yeah, it looked like the Bruins thought that, okay, the Leafs have these ghosts. We're going to roll right over them in our home barn. You know, we haven't played each other since the beginning of the season, basically. We're a much different team. They smoked us last time. Like, we're going to walk all over the Toronto Maple Leafs. They got behind, and I think the biggest difference was they didn't have that composure that the Leafs had. They were chippy, as Blake said, in not a good way, not a way that's going to, like, spark your team. It's a way that's obviously a frustrated type of style. I thought Bunting was his little Marchand self, which helped a little bit with getting underneath the Bruins' skin. A lot of penalties, though. He was in the box a couple times. It seemed to be effective, though. Like, the other team was more focused on Bunting and getting under his skin and seeing what would happen, and obviously giving the Leafs a lot of power play opportunities. But it did seem like the Bruins kind of underestimated the Leafs. And yesterday, you know, you brought up the Steve Dangle interview, and I was in the camp of play the team that you have the demons because you can exercise them and get over it. And I think last night was a really good stepping stone for the Maple Leafs. If they play the Bruins, let's say in the first round, hey, we just went in there and we had a huge statement win on a stringing together two playoff type wins. And I think that'll give them a lot of confidence depending on how the roster situation shakes up. I just think it's a positive, like, you know, with all those things in hand, they're still able to pull out a win. And the Bruins looked a little bit scared.
Yeah, they're chasing their tails a little bit when you're down 6-1 out of nowhere.
They did have some fight to come back, which worried me.
Yeah, but like late.
Yeah,
like,
I wouldn't say Boston looks scared to me, but I did think that they didn't look like the better team. There were a couple things. So I just want to touch on the undisciplined thing. To me, I viewed that a little differently, where I went, they definitely took some bad penalties, But to me, that was a let's try to win the war because we've already lost this battle kind of situation where they went, let's remind these guys that we're going to beat them up, that we're still going to try to just hook and slash and cross check. We're going to lay the lumber all night long. We're going to hit. We're going to rough things up. We're never going to let these guys be comfortable. We're going to keep them on their toes, and we're going to make them question whether or not they can hold up to something like this. But that's what I'm saying is there were three things that made me feel more confident. One of them was that, which was that they continued to stand up, and they were unafraid of the beating that they were taking. They didn't lose their composure at any point in time, even down the stretch when it was getting close. Jeremy Swayman is 23 years old, and he has really good numbers this year on that team, but I didn't see a guy that I would be terrified in a playoff series. And number three is the Leafs had the best line, which is not what has been traditionally the case against Boston. Boston has had the perfection line, and that has scared the crap out of you. And you've thought, okay, well, Toronto needs to have two lines that can match that, but they're not going to have the perfection line. And not that those days have come and gone, because they're obviously incredible players, but a real reminder, again, measuring stick-wise, Leafs have the best line in that matchup. There's no question that where Matthews and Marner are at right now, and Michael Bunting, and Ehlers talking about him running around there and ratting it up big time and driving them nuts, thought he actually kind of had a bad game, considering the penalty he took was oof. But the Leafs have the better line. So you look at those rosters, and they just didn't look like the Boston of old. It's one game, and I know, whatever, we're sounding like big-time homers, but it is interesting that all three of us kind of saw a lot of the same things.
The one thing I would like your take on, JD, is how much do we put into that you told Nick Foligno you were only donating if they lost? It's got to be a big factor as well, right?
I'm 100% donating. It's heartsplaybook.com, and I'm definitely going to be sending them some money today. It's for kids' heart health. Like, you know, you got to be able to do it. But, yes, I couldn't believe how ineffective so many of the tactics started to look. And so I get it. If you're an old school fan, or you're just the type of fan like me that loves to see the physicality get matched, you like to see people stick up for one another. It's one of the things I like about Canada soccer, right, is that they're a group that really sticks up for one another. Granted, in soccer, it's not usually going to result in someone getting sucker punched. I think it would probably be a much bigger story if that was happening at that international level, but I think that the Leafs' version of their toughness is just being able to stand up and take it and not wilt away. And they showed me that last night. They exposed that kid of a goaltender who's from Alaska, so you know I can't stand him. And I just did not see the perfection line dominate the way that Matthews, Marner, and Bunting can dominate.
One thing that I had forgotten about that we were reminded of was how bad the Boston fan bases when things are going poorly. Oh my God, there were some takes last night that, you know, Labushkin dove and that wasn't a real hit, and like, oh my God, I forgot about what it's like to be on Twitter when you play the Boston Bruins. There's a whole nother world that they're watching. We saw a lot of feuds online about some of the injuries and some of the things that happened during last night's game. So
see, I need this briefing report ahead of the show, because I've unlocked something, which is don't go on Twitter. And it's so good. It's so unbelievably good. Okay, so the other things I wanted to touch on that made me feel confident, a little lower down, the new lines. Like, they're working. They look good. We mentioned the fourth line. Blackwell at least does something, right? He's not a perfect player. I don't think that the Leafs wanted to acquire a perfect player. He's tiny, and I thought there were moments where the physicality in that game, if I'm pointing out dudes where I went, oh boy, you don't want that so much. He was one of them. I don't know, Ehlers. I'm not really agreeing with your scouting report of plays bigger than 5'9". I'm not going to go with
hey,
that
there's
one.
There's time.
Yeah, it's like when hits come, he doesn't seem to want them, which I wouldn't either because he's the same size as me. So I totally get it. No criticism whatsoever from me, buddy. Just But he does things, and he can play. And the fourth line was relevant. The third line is operating. It works. Blake, you mentioned Willie Nylander. This is classic. This is how sports takes work, right? Is that it's a long season, and it's regression to the mean. And Nylander's been bad, and now he's playing better. And so anybody that criticized William Nylander is going to look stupid 5 days later because he's going to have now his best stretch of the season. Who cares? It's only going to matter come playoff time. Tavares looks like a rejuvenated guy. And, yeah, I just think that the balance of the team all of a sudden feels right, which is odd because it was just such a – it was a really a simple couple of changes.
What I really liked about the second and third line in particular is the way those line up now is we talked all year about the third line and how they were a shutdown line and a possession-changing line, and you could give them terrible deployment and they'd still mm-hmm. find a way. But what you've done, I think, and what you've stumbled into here by you have Camp and Engvall on one line and you have Mikheyev and Kerfoot on another, and Tavares is obviously, you know, helps in that regard because he's such a strong faceoff winner. You kind of don't have to worry as much about how you deploy those two lines. So you have a night like last night where that Nylander, Camp, Engvall line has probably the most offensive deployment that third line has seen all season. You know, with like a 5-1 offense to defensive zone faceoff split. And then you have, you know, obviously that lets you do some other things. And there are some score effects in this game too, where once it's 6-1, we kind of throw some of the data out. Mm-hmm. But they use that fourth line in their own zone a little bit. And that's, I don't know. I'm not willing to do much with the fourth line other than that was a good game. But really strong possession share, comfort in their own end. I don't think that's something that's going to continue. But having two lines now, if the second and third line look like this, having two lines that you can kind of match up and play how you want, or you can kind of ditch the matchups and be like, well, either line can play in either end. And that's what we saw a little bit last night. So I think, you know, maybe Kasha works back in there somewhere. But I think that Keefe has stumbled on kind of two lines now in 2 and 3 that he can use similarly, or just, you know, go by feel, go by matchup.
The Kasha thing is weird because it's like Muzzin, where I go, I'm not really thinking about you returning right now. And that's a good thing overall. Of course it's a good thing overall. But I didn't miss Kasha last night. I know how well he played earlier in the season, but if I would have thought of somebody in that game that would have left on the stretcher, he would have been number one. And also, he's just not a physical guy whatsoever. And if I would have thought about someone getting a little bit deterred, let's say, by some of Boston's tactics, he would have been a guy that I would have liked to see him actually in this game and see how he would have responded to stuff like this.
I get that for sure. I just look at, you know, we've talked so much about the fourth line and what they can do. And is a Brucey coming in and playing on that line? Well, if the second and third line are good, obviously we're not touching the first line. You tell Kasha, look, man, you've been out. We can't plan for you to have a big role. But you drop him in that Clifford spot on the fourth line, and suddenly
clearly.
Yeah, like so that fourth line then looks like a line that you can play. I mean, you'll still shelter them a little bit because Jason Spezza, but you have Kasha and Blackwell on a line. You kind of like how that line could potentially, you know, shift possession as well.
I totally agree. And in that regard, it's a more obvious fit. With Muzzin, though, I just go with Kasha and Muzzin, both of them. They're supposed to have kind of prominent roles, and we've had these expectations that they're going to have prominent roles. And the more I'm looking at it, the more I'm just thinking, I don't know if that's realistic. Maybe it is Kasha on a fourth line when earlier in the year we were talking about this guy needs to look on the first line. And with Muzzin, we started the year going, this guy needs to be the anchor of their blue line. But guess what? They went out and got a guy at the deadline that might be the best trade of the entire deadline. Honest to God.
Man,
I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury for star last night probably is going to go push for that. But I mentioned this before. Claude Giroux. They gave up a lot for Claude Giroux. And maybe this turns out to be another bite in the ass. But hard to envision Claude Giroux having a bigger impact in the postseason than Mark Giordano. Mark Giordano, do you guys think it's a coincidence that the Leafs' blue line has had, or the team defense has had their four best games since Giordano has arrived? I sure don't. Yeah, Morgan Rielly and TJ Brody are still playing more, as they should. They're younger defensemen who are on the team and who are expected to have bigger roles than Gio. But all of a sudden, Timothy Liljegren looks like a completely new man. And I know the numbers nerds are going to tell me that this is who he's been all season long. He has absolutely not been this guy all season long. He is I won't say rejuvenated because he was never this before. He is born. He's born. Mark Giordano has raised a son, and his name is Timothy Liljegren, and he looks phenomenal. He's out there snapping passes. All of a sudden, he's got a dad who's beside him who shows him the two things that he sucked at the most. One, hey, don't turn the puck over and make stupid plays. I'm a veteran in the league who's playing at age 38. You know why? Because my main thing is I don't turn the puck over. I get it out. I keep it simple. I don't turn the puck over on my own end. Do that. You're going to have a long career, kid. You got all the skill in the world. Just watch me do this. Number two, he's physical. And it's we always talk about it like it's a fighter that makes someone feel like they're a bit taller and a little bit bigger. But Mark Giordano for Timothy Liljegren is you showing up to the bar with your friend who's 6'4" and jacked. And all of a sudden you're going, I'll push this guy. I'm not afraid to push this guy. And that's what I'm seeing with Liljegren around the net. And so I just think he's completely put all the dominoes in the right places. And you just hope that Hall, you hope that Labushkin are okay. But the idea that one of those two guys could draw out and Muzzin's going to come in, I'm going, where's the balance in this? Is it moving Brody to the right and having him play with Muzzin? Because right now I'm not touching that Giordano-Liljegren pair. Like, they're phenomenal. I'm not messing with it whatsoever. That's there for me.
It's funny because we talked so much about how Sandin was one of the brightest futures on the back end. And
haven't thought about him once.
Yeah, I never really thought about Liljegren, and I thought he would be the first person to be kind of bumped out of the roster when everybody was back.
Yep.
And he has completely changed my perspective just because he's beside Giordano. And I think that you touched on it quite a few times, but he just brings that calming presence. And you know, I think that was so needed, a veteran person that just understands how to control the play, how to slow it down, how to make the right pass. Like, he's incredible to watch. I have so much enjoyed watching the Leafs in their own end now and not feeling like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And I think it's just a trickle effect where the goaltending will feel more comfortable, the forwards will feel more comfortable because there's a actual, you know, knowledgeable, calm presence back there. They keep saying an adult presence, and I think that is exactly what you're touching on with the dad situation. It's funny because it's so true. And Liljegren was never somebody that moved the needle for me. I know there's the stats that he could be this guy, but it just, the eye test thing was the thing that I saw. I didn't feel comfortable with him on the ice. Now him and Gio are like one of the most dominant, you know, shut down forces, and they also bringing the offense and the physicality. So I don't think you touch it either. I'm hoping that this is just like a day or two of waiting to figure out what happens with the back end, because those two to me are a lock. I wouldn't be touching them. And yeah, maybe the best trade deadline acquisition. It's definitely in the conversation. So kudos to Dubas for getting that one in.
Well, they got a guy who filled in on their fourth line in Blackwell, who can actually play, who's a real NHL player, right? It's not Kyle Clifford, and no offense, it's right now not this version of Wayne Simmonds.
Mm-hmm.
And you got Blue Line Dad, where all of a sudden you have this presence back there that you just see as steady. He's just so steady. And now you don't have to have everything. Like, this is what my main Liljegren thought was yesterday, is all these stats are so inflated, and I don't know why the nerds won't admit it, but it's because when they go, did you see his expected goals for with Morgan Rielly? I go, yeah, he and Morgan Rielly get put over the boards with Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner in the offenses. Mm-hmm. It accounts for that. Okay, sure. Then he's Chris Pronger. He's Scott Niedermeyer in his prime. You know, actually, he's even better than that. The minutes were completely sheltered, and when he was in his own end, it was a disaster every single time. Mm-hmm. He could obviously make a breakout pass, but that was the only discernible skill that he showed in his own zone. Now he's with a guy who's a play killer, a net front clear, and a puck mover in Mark Giordano. And Gio looks, he doesn't look 38. He looks so good that if the Leafs, like, what Leaf fan would be upset if they announced the Giordano extension tonight? Like, or this morning, they go, Mark Giordano's extended through the next season. He's agreed to take a contract. You would go, that's incredible. It really does raise, it's not for really today because we're celebrating, not celebrating, we're discussing what this team is going to look like against the Bruins and look like in this version of the playoffs. But, yeah, if Mark Giordano does want to come back and you can get a better version of Justin Hall, which they have seen from him with Brody. I don't know how you could say that he's looked like early season Justin Hall. You're not prioritizing a guy like Ilya Lyubushkin to play with Morgan Rielly, but he's looked solid there. And your blue line hasn't missed Jake Muzzin. And you're obviously going to bring back your number one young player. I should say younger player. In Rasmus Sandin, and he's 100% going to play with this group. How do they balance those puzzle pieces, and who are the guys that are on the way out? Because right now it feels a little balanced. Right now it feels pretty quality, and it won't always feel that way, but it is going to present them with some pretty interesting questions. Like, they could never find a blue liner. These guys were playing Cody Ceci and Tyson Barry and trying to pump their tires and say to the fan base they were, you know, the old saying, don't spit on my neck and tell me it's raining. That was Kyle Dubas with those defensemen. Now we're watching these guys and there's finally balance and they actually have depth at the position. You feel quite good about it.
Well, you do. I was going to say, it's funny. You feel good about the depth at the position because we just went through eight guys who you potentially have to sort your way through next year. I know some people are high on Carl Dahlstrom's ability to step into a third pair role too. I know you're not banking on that or anything, but he's very cheap at the just over the minimum if you need a cheap seventh defenseman or whatever. But we got to be realistic. They're going to have to pinch at the margins with the cap situation.
Of course.
But it does kind of highlight that defensive depth is great and this looks solid, but you can never have too much defensive depth. Like, we just went through eight defensemen that could theoretically slot into a playoff defense rotation or a opening night 2022 playoff rotation or defense rotation, and four of those guys might play tomorrow. Like,
there's also no the such question of no, I was going to say depth. The same question with the depth of the goaltending. We know way too many names of the goaltending depth scary. Of the Toronto Maple Leafs now. It's scary. Like, we're pulling up names and, okay, here's our eighth option. He's now bumped up to four.
Yeah, me trying, scrambling last night to find the rules of, like, trying to find the rules of, like, hey, is there a way to get Harri Sateri back? Like, how can you steal him back on waivers? Is there, like, do you get dibs if he was your own guy and he gets waived?
I saw that the Marlies played a goaltender last night. It was his first start and his first win. I'm like, well, get ready to be called up, buddy. Taylor Joseph was his name, and we're going to be probably hearing his name soon on the
Taylor Leafs, Joseph
practicing with them.
Nah, it's Hutch. You thought you'd never hear that name again with the emergence of
No, I was hoping I wouldn't.
I can't believe that at the end of that game, I really felt like, boy, that sucks losing Mrazek. That's not good. I didn't like
and
feeling that.
It didn't
that.
Sound promising. Like the
no, he's
discussions,
done.
They said he might be out
injury.
For a while.
Yeah. Honestly, if there's really... He was never as bad as his lowest of lows here, even though you could probably question the whole, do some guys have the temperament to play in Toronto? But the fact that Mrazek is not only someone who is bad, but also someone who is heavily injury prone and hard to believe that he was going to stay healthy for a season, it's just, listen, Dubas deserves a lot of credit for things this season. So it feels like a weird spot to say, but it's just such a bad signing. It's just such an incredibly bad signing to give an injury prone goaltender with a track record of up and down play a 3-year contract at $4 million on a capped out team. I just, every time, it just, even when he starts to turn around, you go, because I think we were all doing the same thing of, you know, or maybe we weren't, but I was. I went, you know, it's good that they didn't overreact and panic trade Mrazek at his lowest of lows, where it was going to cost you a major asset to get off of him at the deadline, and that they're going to carry this into the offseason, and maybe he comes back next year, and he's actually just okay, because all you need is a competent backup goaltender, and $4 million isn't that bad, and then maybe you can move him at the next year's deadline when it's only a year and a half left, or who knows. And then he goes down with that injury, and you're just like, ugh, the 1 second you felt a little bit of hope and you're reminded that it's not just bad play, it's that this guy has a wonky groin, which, in case you don't know, is bad for goalies. So,
wonky groin.
Yeah, I just I think the same thing remains, that this team is good, that that Giordano trade was quality, but it's going to be really hard to justify the way that this team approached the goaltending if they get bounced in the postseason because they can't get a save. I don't know how at your exit meetings or whatever you're going to trust a group that, like, I was texting a friend last night. You got to fire everybody who's had anybody who's come within 10 feet of goaltending decisions with this organization. It's got to go. Like, you got to go. You got to hire a whole new department for goalie assessment, goalie contracts, goalie headspace, all of it.
And like, some of it too is, like, obviously these guys wouldn't be NHL relevant, but it does feel like a bit of a cursed position right now. The Marlies are on their 8th goalie of the season. That kid who started last night, Ailish, was on loan from Trinity Western University.
I never should have quit. Mm-hmm.
Who are 2-17, and he has a goals against average of almost 6.
He's got an undefeated AHL record now.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure that's where Sean Kemp played. Like, Trinity.
Yeah, Trinity Western. Yeah.
Like, this is not good. We're getting Sean Kemp's goalie in here with a 2-17 record.
Yeah. But basically, he was like an e-bug. Like, they're playing in Abbotsford and Trinity Western's down the road.
Oh,
and
boy.
That's the 8th goalie this year for the
here
Marlies.
We go.
So,
okay.
It is a organizational wide issue. I don't know what you mentioned the Growlers days. I don't know what their goaltending situation is.
Yeah,
I don't know if you can get Keith Petrozelli
here
on a plane or what, but let's fingers crossed that those reports that Jack Campbell is, you know, inching closer to a regular practice, that he's around the corner, because Mrazek's 3rd groin injury, even if it's not that bad, you're just like, we can't go into the playoffs with him penciled into a role, right? Like, you just if he's a backup and he's healthy for that, great. But this is, at this point, it has to be Jack Campbell. There's not really a discussion around it anymore.
Well, it's more that if you just look at the track record of his injuries, this takes him out of the playoffs. Like, this takes him out of at least the start of the playoffs. And now,
and even if it doesn't, you just you can't rely on him anything other than, okay, we upgraded the backup position. Like, we're not doing a timeshare anymore. We're not doing whose net is it? I don't think you can.
Nope. It's what I said before. Kyle Dubas put his job security into the hands of Jack Campbell at the deadline, and they have got to live with that. Let's take a break. Let's come back. Let's do the A-list, and let's set up draws and pots, and what do pots go in what pods, and what tickets go where, and what number needs to fall for Canada Soccer to have a better shot. It's the Fan Morning Show. J.D. Bungus, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy. Subscribe to this podcast and follow us on the socials. The A-List, next.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Morning show, Sportsnet 590. Hump day. Remember when you guys didn't know what that was?
We knew. We just didn't want to. Yeah, we just didn't want to encourage you and enable you yelling hump day as people are driving on the highway.
Hey, that one was that wasn't me. That was recorded. Vic's on fire. I got a couple A-list things today. Hopefully, I can squeeze them all in, but. We got to talk about
I'm curious how Eric Church works.
Eric Church. Well, he's number one on the A-list.
Now it's time for the A-list.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
What's up, baby?
Country artist Eric Church is getting some heat online after he canceled his shows this upcoming weekend so that he can attend the Final Four. He sent a message through Ticketmaster to everybody at his couple concerts San Antonio is one of them. And this is what he said in the actual Ticketmaster cancellation. To the church choir, I guess that's what he calls his fans. This Saturday, my family and I are going to stand together to cheer on the Tar Heels as the team has made it to the Final Four. As a lifelong Carolina basketball fan, I've watched Carolina Duke battle over the years, but to have them match up in the Final Four is any sport enthusiast's dream. This is also the most selfish thing I've ever asked the choir to do, to give up your Saturday night plans with us so I can have this moment with my family and the sports community. However, it's the same type of passion felt by the people who fill the seats at our concerts that make us want to be a part of the crowd of this significance.
I love this so much. A guy who's so big a sports fan, he cancels his own shows. Also, like, I knew he was from North Carolina, but I quickly looked up where he went to school. I was like, oh, was he a Tar Heel? And no, he went to Appalachian State, which is in Boone, North Carolina. So he he did the excellent, like, I love this about fandom in the U.S. because there are a million colleges and universities, right? Mm-hmm. And so many people go to ones that, hey, that school is not worth rooting for or making part of your sports identity, so we'll root for the biggest program nearby. And I know he grew up in North Carolina too, but I love this. This is great. JD, I can't tell if you're about to agree or you hate this.
Probably
but
not.
I'm Eric Church, top of the country music artist ranking for me now.
It's one of those things where his explanation to people, they're either going to get it or not. And the media press release or the fan press release is in no way going to change anybody. You're going to be in the camp like Blake and I, where we go, man, if I had a lot of money, you know what I would want to do more than – I would say that right now, if I could choose to go to any sporting event for this calendar year, more than the Super Bowl, more than Monaco, more than anything, I would want to see – UNC versus Duke in the Final Four.
In Coach K's last game, mm-hmm. potentially.
UNC embarrassed Duke at Cameron Indoor in Coach K's final game there. And now they're meeting in the Final freaking Four. They are unquestionably the biggest rivalry in college sports. And they have yet to meet in this spot. It's massive. It's monumental. It's the biggest story in sports. I know that we're caring about the Boston Bruins and the Toronto Maple Leafs south of the border. This is probably nonstop 24-hour news talk about how these two teams match up. If you were in North Carolina right now, you would be thinking that a war is happening because of the way that people are preparing for this. I don't fault Eric Church whatsoever, because if I had money and I was a Tar Heels fan or a Duke Blue Devils fan, this is 100% what I would be doing. I will say, however, my only slight pushback is that when you're excited to go to an event and you're an Eric Church fan, and I don't have kids, but you get the sitter lined up. Like, we all know that growing older, it's harder to make plans, and events are, you know, important. Especially now coming back from the pandemic. I appreciate living in Toronto so much more now, right? We're starting to do stuff. I went to stand-up comedy. I'm looking at Ticketmaster for where I'm going to or what shows I'm going to go see. I'm already starting to duck into random bars to see live music. It's incredible. But the idea that you were going to see Eric Church for the first time post-pandemic, and you got your new boots, and you got your new shirt, and you got your tight jeans, and you're getting ready, you and the missus, and then Eric Church tells you that you're not going out tonight, I'd be pretty sour. I'd be pretty upset in my britches, like, that's for sure. But anyway, so I get how people would be mad, but I also totally, as a sports fan, think this is unbelievably justified. How do you feel about it, Ailish? What do you think?
No, I think you can see it both ways. I obviously think it's awesome that he's a huge sports fan. I think, you have the money, you do whatever you want. But I did feel for a lot of the responses. You know, one guy said, I'm flying in $800 in flights. I rented a car. I'm getting a hotel. And I have two tickets. And he, like, put all his receipts. And, like, it was thousands of dollars that he was going to pay to go see this. And he's going to
I got to tell you, Eric Church,
he's going to get the tickets. Well, yeah, he's going to get the tickets refunded, but he's not going to get all the other things that a lot of people put into this like trip. They were making a trip out of it, and that you sometimes you just can't refund that.
I think
how is he
going
to be able to refund,
guy.
You know, 20,000 people and all their travel plans and all their, you know, rental cars or hotels? Like, it'll be, I don't think he will be able to do that. He'll refund their tickets and maybe say, you know, I'll give you a discount to your next ticket purchase. But there's a lot that goes into going to a concert if you don't live in the exact same city.
Yeah, but that's the thing, though, is that Eric Church isn't exactly like, okay, it's the Eric Church reunion tour, one night only. Like, it's not as though this is people flying in for Elton John, right?
No,
this
but a lot of people did. And, you know, I think it being their first concert back, some people probably, like, made it a weekend. But, no, I mean, that's just maybe out of the 20,000 people going.
Honestly, then they're not members of the choir. Because the choir, in the church choir, we ask you to be humble. We ask you to sacrifice. We ask you to come together as a community and not gripe in these difficult times. And so for you to come out and tell Eric Church about your grievances and your financial problems, now is not the time. Now is not the time. Let Eric Church go and enjoy his North Carolina basketball, and he will return. He will return.
You just have to eat your
$10,000
slipping from Carolina to Texas. And now all I'm imagining is like a different version of Eric Church being like, well, I got to cancel the concert. The Dillon Panthers made they're going to state.
Listen, if the Dillon Panthers go to state, he's got to go.
Do we have time? Victorious canceling all their shows.
Ailish, I totally get it. And like I said, I empathize with those people truly. Like that is a tough one. But if I am him and his PR team, I'm totally working with, hey, did you fly in for this show? Eric Church is taking care of it. I'm putting that out there and saying, if you flew, I'll pay for your flights. He's Eric freaking Church. He's so rich that he can cancel shows where he's probably clearing $1 million on a show like this or getting pretty damn near close to it. So, yeah, I'm thinking that if he's willing to sacrifice that, he can sacrifice another, you know, 50 grand to 100. Like, what are we talking about here? 50 grand, 100 grand in terms of covering some people's expenses and bills? Like, yeah, I think he could cover it. He can cover the choir.
Yeah, he can cover the choir. Another sacrifice that has to be made. Ailish, I know you have more A-list items. We're going to come back to the A-list at 7:30. Right now, though, it's time for a look at the Canadian men's soccer team, and it's brought to you by CertainTeed, the pro's choice for roofing, siding, drywall, insulation, and ceiling systems. CertainTeed, pro all the way. So, Canada's last World Cup qualifying game tonight, you might be thinking, oh, they qualified for the World Cup. What's left to play for? Is this a game where you play the young guys or you let Atiba pad the caps and get a 95th in there or whatever? No, Canada's in Panama tonight for a 9 o'clock game. This game, actually, the way the other regions have shaken out, this game is really important now to the extent that I think Herdman will probably go with his best lineup. So if Canada wins tonight, not only do they win the top of the table for CONCACAF qualifying and take the octagon and things like that, but a win would push them into pot three when it comes to setting up the World Cup groups. What that and a loss or draw would have them in pot four. What that means is, I explained the other day that the way the World Cup groups are set up is the 32 teams are put into four pots, one to seven and Qatar, and then 9, 8 through 15 and so on, based on your overall FIFA points with some geographic juggling. And though that's how the groups are determined. So if Canada is pot three, that means they get a pot four team in their group. That means they get a worse team by FIFA rankings in their group. If they're in pot four, that means they're the bottom team in their group. You want to talk about Canada potentially drawing a group of death or something like that? Losing tonight, drawing tonight, and falling into pot four leaves a little more room for that to happen, where maybe you're playing against a Senegal or a Serbia as the pot three team instead of, hey, a Mali or an Ecuador or a Ghana or something like that out of pot four. So big stakes in this game if you've already turned the page and are looking ahead to, hey, how could Canada do in the World Cup? Not just about the top of the table tonight. It's about setting the stage now. You've qualified. Tonight you can give yourself just a little bit of a boost in terms of your odds of getting out of the group stage at the World Cup.
It's the perfect explanation. That's it.
A little rambly, but...
Yeah, but that's... you want the Coles notes from a rambler? Mm-hmm. You lose tonight, you play a higher-ranked opponent.
That's it.
You win tonight, you play a lower-ranked opponent in the World Cup in your group. I love this because we get one more game of Canada soccer where there's stakes and where we get to see the A lineup. Why would we rest these guys anyway? Why would these guys want rest right now? They should be coming off an emotional high. The only thing I'm actually kind of curious about is these dudes went out on Sunday and got obliterated, and then they went into Monday and carried the celebration through. Is like getting to actually see what the recovery looks like for these guys is going to be pretty interesting. Overall, it doesn't seem like it actually is the biggest of deals. So if you ever put that take out there of these guys celebrate, like, you know, when the Blue Jays clinched in 2015 and everyone had the take of, you're not supposed to celebrate before the job
and
is done.
And Stroman in his hoodie with the hangover shakes the next day on the bench.
I really hate cancel culture, but if you have that take of Canada soccer celebrated too soon, you're canceled. Okay, canceled.
You're out of here. All right, that look at the Canadian men's soccer team was brought to you by CertainTeed, the pro's choice for roofing, siding, drywall, insulation, and ceiling systems. CertainTeed, pro all the way. Again, that's Canada at Panama tonight, 9:05 on Sportsnet. We're gonna take a break. When we come back, we're gonna keep it in the Sportsnet family. Ben Nicholson-Smith coming to us from Dunedin. He's out here retweeting the show's tweets at 6:02 a.m. What is this guy doing with his time in Dunedin? The Jays have an off day yesterday. I think, maybe Ben's going to enjoy the sights.
He slept
enjoy the
in
sun.
For 2 minutes.
Nope. He's ready to go. Ben Nicholson-Smith after the break. And then we'll get to a few more A-list items in the 7:30 block. A little later on, we've got Luke Fox and Justin Bourne coming on to talk Toronto Maple Leafs. And Tim Bonteps at 9:30 to talk, whip around the Atlantic Division and talk about the NBA MVP. But next is Ben Nicholson-Smith, The Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.